Morgan Jerkin's memoir, This Will Be My Undoing, arrives like a thunderclap in American literature, a raw, unflinching exploration of Black womanhood that has captivated readers across demographics since its 2018 publication. The book shot to the New York Times bestseller list and became required reading in universities nationwide, with Roxane Gay calling it a powerful, important work from a talented, committed writer. Jerkins doesn't just tell her story. She dissects the experience of being both Black and female in America with surgical precision, offering readers a rare window into the psychological toll of navigating white spaces while maintaining one's identity. What makes this work particularly resonant is how Jerkins transforms her personal experiences into universal insights about race, gender, and power in America, all while maintaining her distinct, unapologetic voice that refuses to soften its edges for white comfort. At 10 years old, all I wanted was to become a white cheerleader. Growing up in Atlantic County, New Jersey, television had taught me that cheerleaders, invariably white, thin, and desirable, embodied both power and purity. When elementary school tryouts came, I found myself among just four Black girls competing against 30 white candidates. I studied these white girls intently, noting how freely their bodies moved, as if unrestrained by invisible boundaries. They helped me practice, perhaps because of my light skin or my family's local prominence, while I mentally distanced myself from my actual friends of color, hoping whiteness might somehow transfer to me through proximity. On tryout night, I performed flawlessly. The euphoria afterward felt limitless, until results were posted and only white names appeared on the list. Days later, a Filipina friend delivered the crushing blow. They don't accept monkeys like you on the team. In that moment, I understood my fundamental problem wasn't lack of skill, but lack of humanity in others' eyes. This realization haunted me. Around my Black friends, I could simply be myself, but in white spaces, I wasn't afforded basic humanity. Perhaps that's what I was really auditioning for, not a position on a cheerleading squad, but recognition as a fully human being. This childhood experience revealed the cruel paradox many Black women face throughout their lives. No matter how well we perform, how perfectly we speak, how appropriately we dress, or how extensively we achieve, there remains an invisible barrier, a glass ceiling reinforced not by our limitations, but by others' perceptions of our fundamental worth. The cheerleading rejection wasn't merely about not making a team. It was my first conscious encounter with the dehumanization that would follow me into adulthood, shaping how I navigated predominantly white spaces and institutions. What's most insidious about this experience is how it taught me to question my own value. If I couldn't be seen as human despite my best efforts, what hope did I have for true belonging? This question would resurface repeatedly throughout my life, from academic settings to professional environments, creating a perpetual sense of performing for acceptance rather than simply existing as myself. When I was 3 years old, my mother's friend applied my first chemical relaxer, transforming my thick afro into straight strands. Though light-skinned enough to be jokingly called the milkman's baby, my obsidian hair unmistakably marked my Blackness. The initial coolness of the chemicals quickly turned to searing pain, beginning a decade-long ritual of suffering for beauty. I grew up absorbing the concepts of good and bad hair, learning through observation that white beauty standards represented the ideal. While white girls worried about lip gloss shades, Black girls scrutinized each other's hair length and authenticity. From ages 3 to 15, I endured chemical relaxers every 4 to 6 weeks, experiencing excruciating pain as substances strong enough to unclog drains burned my scalp. I became obsessed with straightness and length, believing these qualities would help me transcend my Blackness. Now natural for as many years as I once permed, I understand the tremendous pressure Black women face to look presentable by white standards. Black women's hair has always been politicized, from 18th century categorization as wool to contemporary school bans on natural styles. schools across America continue enforcing discriminatory hair guidelines, prohibiting Afro puffs, dreadlocks, and braids as distracting or unprofessional. When we straighten our hair with chemical products, we surrender to dominant white culture, appearing more docile to secure jobs and navigate social circles. After quitting relaxers cold turkey at 15, my hair broke off dramatically. I concealed the damage with braids, weaves, and wigs, never satisfied because I couldn't accept what naturally grew from my scalp. No genuine happiness could come from extending what brought me shame. The Rachel Dolezal controversy in 2015 forced me to examine what Black womanhood truly means beyond textured hair and brown skin. Dolezal, the NAACP Spokane chapter president, exposed for masquerading as a Black woman despite having white parents, wore bronze foundation and traditionally African-American hairstyles, claiming to be transracial, an insult to people of color who cannot choose their racial identity. Though I abhor what she did, Dolezal caused me to question the essence of Black womanhood. Since slavery, Black womanhood has represented the perverse and grotesque in Western imagination. Sarah Sargi Bartman, the Hottentot Venus, exemplifies this, a South African woman whose body became entertainment for Europeans due to her stedipedia. After her death at 26, her skeleton was preserved and her brain and genitals displayed in jars at Paris's Museum of Man until 1974. Black women aren't afforded ownership of our bodies, while white women can appropriate them for selfish desires. Magazines praise Kylie Jenner's epic cornrows, while Black women face workplace discrimination for the same style. Our features are considered epic and regal only when not on Black female bodies. When Black women try to look white with weaves or contacts, we're still seen as Black women with artificial additions, never as white women. But Dolezal, despite darkening her skin, still inhabits a white female body, with the privilege to wear Blackness as costume and become intellectualized rather than stigmatized. When I was 11, my cousin Mia gave me my first lesson about inappropriate behavior from male classmates. Her warning carried multiple meanings I wouldn't understand until later. In sixth grade, I began noticing how social hierarchies shaped peer interactions, with clear preferences based on racial background. My classmates demonstrated troubling behaviors during recess, with certain groups being targeted more than others. The social dynamics created pressure to be chosen, even when the attention was unwanted. I found myself drawn to Juan, a popular student who showed interest in specific groups while treating others differently. To fit in, I studied how my Black female friends carried themselves, their confidence, speech patterns, and social presence. I changed my clothing choices from mainstream brands to styles I thought would earn acceptance. My goal was to find an appropriate balance between fitting in and following school rules. When I finally achieved my desired look with a UNC sports dress, I received the attention I'd sought. However, Juan's interest was fleeting. He soon returned to Casey, a popular cheerleader. My mother cautioned me about being labeled with a particular term used in our community, one that carried heavy cultural implications. This warning wasn't just about clothing choices, but about broader social perceptions. Reading Zadie Smith's Swing Time later helped me understand how these childhood experiences affected young Black girls internationally, describing similar social dynamics across cultures. The term my mother warned me about wasn't simple criticism. It represented complex cultural protective mechanisms, though often with unintended negative effects. Black girlhood carries unique challenges from an early age. Young Black girls face pressure to exceed standard expectations, maintain specific appearances, and navigate strict behavioral expectations. Society often denies Black girls the space for normal childhood development. The labels applied to them lack male counterparts, highlighting a double standard in how behavior is judged. When young Black males face criticism, it typically focuses on different aspects of their presentation. Even within their own communities, young Black girls often struggle to find acceptance. This experience reflects broader patterns of how society views and treats young Black girls, denying them the basic protections of childhood while holding them to impossible standards. At Princeton, I faced the painful reality of being overlooked romantically. Though my mother and grandmother expected college to be where I'd find a husband, the odds were against me. Black women outnumbered black men 3-1, and I was determined to prove I wasn't unattractive to men of my community. Despite joining the Princeton Association of Black Women and successfully bickering into Cannon Eating Club, populated by top athletes, my efforts to be seen at parties failed. My invisibility was confirmed when a black football player friend asked me to help list Princeton's most attractive black women. I wasn't among them. I felt untouchable, at the bottom of our caste system. After being stood up by a black grad student and experiencing other failed connections without closure, I wondered if something was intrinsically wrong with me. I began to question if my outspoken nature was the problem. The other black women who attracted men seemed less vocal and more reserved than I was. By graduation, I'd never been in a relationship or even kissed someone during those 4 years. At 22, I reconnected with Bradley, a childhood friend who'd always admired me. When he invited me on an all-expenses-paid trip to Nevada, I didn't hesitate, desperate for male attention after my Princeton drought. Despite his expectation of sex, I refused penetration but performed oral sex, not from desire but obligation. I viewed it as payment for his investment and a way to be docile with the mouth that had perhaps kept men away. After returning home, we maintained intimacy through video calls and declared love despite the distance. I prepared for my next visit by getting birth control, planning to lose my virginity. But after my mother's prayer that anything hidden would be revealed, Bradley confessed he wasn't ready for exclusivity. He wanted to travel and sleep with other women. The breakup shattered me. I cried whenever someone mentioned his name, kept my phone close hoping for a message, and sought therapy. In retrospect, losing my virginity to him would have been traumatic. But at the time, I hated myself for thinking I deserved more than billions of other women who have sex without commitment. As my stepfather battled frontotemporal lobe dementia, I struggled with my own mental health. After a near house fire caused by his condition, I developed anxiety and OCD behaviors, checking locks and stove knobs repeatedly, fearing sudden self-harm. Though diagnosed by a campus psychologist, I resisted further treatment, believing black people do not do therapy, despite my stepfather being a psychologist himself. I justified this resistance by citing historical medical exploitation of black bodies, from J. Marion Sims' gynecological experiments on enslaved women, to Henrietta Lacks' stolen cells, to Benjamin Rush's racist psychiatric theories about negritude. I internalized the strong black woman stereotype, the belief that black women must endure all suffering without complaint, serving as the backbone for family and community. This ideal appears complementary, but actually dehumanizes by denying our vulnerabilities and needs. This resilience has been reclaimed through Black Girl Magic, a movement popularized by Kishon Thompson to counteract negative images of black women by celebrating achievements of figures like Beyoncé, Simone Biles, and Michelle Obama. The Black Girl Magic movement celebrates black women's bodily autonomy after generations of exploitation, our bodies violated during slavery, our features denigrated, our womanhood used against us. But for disabled black women, bodily autonomy involves battling limitations from within and discrimination from without. As Crystal R. Emery noted, being a wheelchair-riding quadriplegic black woman means facing triple stigmatization. Our dismissal of Dr. Chavers's critique reveals our ableist privilege, as her follow-up piece received barely 126 Facebook shares compared to her original essay's 9,000. We must recognize and celebrate black women with disabilities rather than continuing their erasure. Surprisingly, my religious mother suggested I try therapy months before my stepfather passed. She made my first appointment and offered to sit with me. Though initially fidgety and clock-watching, I soon felt weights lifting from my heart. I finally had someone to discuss my feelings of weakness without embarrassment. As a black woman at an Ivy League university, I'd felt pressured to maintain perfection in a space not originally meant for people like me. My therapist helped me restructure my thought process without challenging my religious beliefs. Meanwhile, after my stepfather passed, my mother hovered near depression, exhausted from caregiving and gaining over 100 pounds from stress. I encouraged her to attend a support group, which revitalized her. Gradually, my OCD symptoms subsided, the checking behaviors, nighttime panic, and fear diminished. Though occasional compulsions still arise, I'm learning to trust myself more. My treatment in St. Petersburg, Russia, was milder than what other Black visitors have experienced, but the threat of danger was omnipresent. Russians would stare unblinkingly at me for uncomfortably long periods, with stoic faces and unyielding eyes. Not attraction, but surveillance. With limited vocabulary, I couldn't confront this rudeness. It took weeks before I felt comfortable riding the metro alone. Once, when I did venture out alone, a man followed me from the token booth onto the train, creating such unease that I had to strategically slip between other passengers to escape at my stop, knowing I couldn't blend into the crowd because of my Blackness. At Mishka Bar with fellow students, I finally relaxed, feeling I could pretend I wasn't different from anyone else. But when we followed locals to another bar, a drunk Russian man pinned me against a wall. Michael rescued me, but at the next establishment, we encountered skinheads. I grabbed Daniel and fled immediately, while our white Edinburgh companions stayed behind, even joining in Nazi salutes, which they later claimed was from fear. Their giggles suggested it was just another wild story they could afford because they were white. Meanwhile, I was terrified, knowing Zambian students had been beaten and a Senegalese student shot dead in this same city. The white students expressed sympathy when I explained my fear, but they couldn't truly understand. This terror wasn't theirs to know. I'd never lived in a predominantly Black space before Harlem. Growing up, I was taught not to embarrass my mother with certain behaviors or dress when in white spaces. My dialect modulated, gesticulations moderated, voice quieted, hair tamed. I considered this proper and normal for success in white domains. But in Harlem, I was unprepared for how out of element I felt. My education in white spaces had reduced my own culture to disconnected historical images: the Cotton Club, Apollo, Baldwin, Holiday, crack, and crime. I couldn't adjust to the block parties, late-night arguments, rap music, men sitting on crates outside barbershops, or street vendors. Despite sharing race with my neighbors, I wasn't from the same culture. I felt closer to my white, gay, Republican roommate Thomas than to my neighbors. We bonded over literature and trap music, discussing gentrification. He believed neither of us would be living in Harlem without it. I wondered if I, college-educated and upwardly mobile, was as much a gentrifier as Thomas was. This introspection led to my viral Guardian article, which drew both praise and criticism. I frequented upscale Harlem establishments like Cove Lounge and Red Rooster, a curated version of Harlem life. My confusion stemmed from realizing I'd always used white behavior as my reference point and didn't know how to exist in a Black space. I felt closer to my white, gay, Republican roommate Thomas than to my neighbors. We bonded over literature and trap music, discussing gentrification. He believed neither of us would be living in Harlem without it. I wondered if I, college-educated and upwardly mobile, was as much a gentrifier as Thomas was. This introspection led to my viral Guardian article, which drew both praise and criticism. I frequented upscale Harlem establishments like Cove Lounge and Red Rooster, a curated version of Harlem life. My confusion stemmed from realizing I'd always used white behavior as my reference point and didn't know how to exist in a Black space. When Beyoncé released Lemonade on HBO in April 2016, I wasn't prepared for its impact. Despite my tendency to avoid hyped releases, I watched it for an L.com assignment and found myself broken open by its raw melodies of heartbreak and grief. I mourned relationships I'd never had, sons I'd never birthed, marriages I'd never entered. Watching with my mother, who had experienced betrayal firsthand, helped me understand the deeper resonance. On Twitter that night, Black women filled a reservoir of emotions they might not have fully articulated, but felt deeply in their souls. Beyoncé had awakened something dormant in us all. Lemonade wasn't about uplifting Black people generally, but Black women specifically. The 2014 French film Girlhood centers on Mariem, a 16-year-old black girl in a poor Parisian suburb seeking belonging through friendship with other black girls. The film magnificently explores how black girls navigate a racist, patriarchal society where poverty seems predetermined. Unlike typical coming-of-age stories, these teenagers aren't focused on psychological growth, but mere survival, occasionally escaping through song and dance. Despite my admiration for the film, I was troubled to discover director Celine Sciamma, a white middle-class woman, claimed the film wasn't about race, but was universal. She based it on observations of black girls in shopping centers without apparently speaking to them, believing her experience of marginality as a white middle-class woman somehow compared to theirs. Sciamma's claim that she wanted to give a face to French youth implies black girls lack visibility without her intervention. This reinforces her role as white benefactor while positioning black girls as nameless subjects. Though Girlhood is brilliantly crafted, a black woman from a poor Parisian suburb could have told this story more authentically without being a spectator. Similarly, Orange is the New Black's fourth season explored racism and prison brutality toward black women without black women writers. The reality of systemic barriers raises difficult questions. Would a black French female director have had the opportunity to direct Girlhood? Would a black woman's prison memoir receive the same attention as the white middle-class memoir that inspired OITNB? Must we accept stories told by non-black women as better than nothing? Why is the film titled Girlhood rather than Black Girlhood or Mariem? Sciamma's insistence on universality reveals how whiteness assumes itself as the center of any experience. Her statements about making characters universal demonstrate her forcing herself into a narrative that was never hers. She didn't merely observe these black girls' bodies, she confiscated them to reproduce the white fallacy that progress requires erasing racial identities. To divorce race from girlhood ignores the invisible forces restricting these characters. The fantasy that black girls can simply be girls in an unraced way removes them from the narrative center. Contrasting this with Lemonade, a visual experience co-directed by a black woman that keeps black women unapologetically centered, shows why I refuse to resign myself to white-directed narratives of black experience. The author deeply examines the complex dynamics of professional relationships among black women writers, reflecting on both the painful experiences of being denied support and her conscious decision to break this cycle. She describes specific instances where established black writers refuse to share industry contacts or offer mentorship, analyzing how the publishing industry's tokenism creates an environment where black women often feel they must compete for limited opportunities. This scarcity mindset manifests in subtle ways: unreturned emails, deflected requests for introductions, and a general atmosphere of guardedness that perpetuates isolation. Drawing from her own journey, she commits to a different approach, detailing her practice of responding to emerging black female writers within 48 hours and maintaining an open-door policy for sharing professional contacts. However, she candidly acknowledges her own occasional struggles with comparison and competition, describing moments when another black woman's success triggered feelings of insecurity. These reflections reveal the ongoing internal work required to maintain solidarity in a system designed to pit marginalized voices against each other. The author vividly recalls a pivotal childhood experience, trying out for an all-white cheerleading squad at age 10. She describes meticulously practicing her routine, carefully calibrating her smile and body language to appear non-threatening to the white judges, only to face rejection while watching her white friends celebrate their success. This early lesson in racial dynamics would echo throughout her academic career, particularly at Princeton, where she encountered both subtle and overt attempts to question her belonging in elite spaces. She describes specific incidents of microaggressions and outright hostility, including a memorable confrontation where someone attempted to remind her of her place. Rather than being diminished by these experiences, she transformed them into fuel for excellence, taking particular satisfaction in disrupting spaces traditionally closed to Black women. It was not only our presence that made them mad, but our excellence, she writes. This was their nightmare and my joy. This defiance becomes a recurring theme in her professional life. Morgan Jerkin's memoir serves as both personal narrative and cultural critique, methodically documenting the ways Black womanhood is systematically challenged in American society. Through detailed analysis of her experiences in education, publishing, and professional spaces, she illuminates the broader structures of racism and sexism. Her evolution from seeking white approval to embracing and celebrating her identity offers a powerful template for resistance. By maintaining raw honesty about her experiences, including moments of vulnerability and triumph, Jerkins creates an authentic narrative that challenges readers to confront their own biases while providing validation and inspiration for other Black women navigating similar spaces. The memoir ultimately demonstrates how the very attributes society attempts to suppress in Black women, their intelligence, resilience, sexuality, and voice, become powerful tools for transformation and liberation.